You haven't watched any TV, huh? You're off the TV right now
because of
the
video games. Yeah, I'm just kind of handcuffed to a controller.
What do you guys
through games as fast as possible right now?
What do you guys do for you don't have cable anymore?
No.
No.
We have YouTube TV.
Oh.
We have
YouTube
TV.
Oh.
Courtesy of a family member? I don't know. Is that sanctioned? Should I be saying this publicly?
You're allowed to have a direct family members are allowed to share.
What if it is a direct family
member? So you can share with your children?
They made some changes recently that made it seem like they want those family members to live in the same household, though.
So with my Hulu TV subscription, which is like their version of the YouTube, like it's their cable bundle, basically, you have to check in on the mobile devices at the location that it's registered
at. That's
what
it was. That's
every specific period of time.
The error message that started popping up was like, hey, use this from the Wi-Fi that you normally use it on or something. Like, you know, very clearly they wanted it to be from like the IP range that they expect the owner of the account to be on.
Yeah. With Hulu, it's like you can go away for a month or something and then you have to check, but you have to check in. But the set-top never has any of that. It may be because that's the one we set up first. Huh, okay. I don't know. Yeah.
We were getting this on set-top apps, but.
Oh, that's weird. Well, you should switch to Hulu TV. It's great.
I don't know if we should. I feel so strange talking about this in public. What if Google is listening?
They are listening.
No.
You have Google Assistant on your iPad, right?
They're listening right now. They hear you.
They
can't take my TV away.
Well, I mean, you said you don't use it. They can take it away. You're fine. You have CBS All Access. That's all anybody needs.
It is America's most watched network.
It is. You can get all the NCIS you want there. Hello, Brad.
Hi, Will.
It's time to make a tech pod.
Let's do it. It's talking to the microphones.
Yep.
About tech.
This is our new tradition.
Mm-hmm.
The every fourth week question episode.
Yes.
Let us know how you feel about this.
Went to the Department of Dead Letters.
Yes.
And resurrected a few. Got down on our knees and, you know, sacrificed a goat.
There is a letter in there that is so spectacularly good.
Yeah.
It is my favorite piece of content from that game, from Control. We're talking about Control.
Yes.
It is exceptional. It is every crank letter we ever got sent into the magazine condensed into one, like four paragraphs of perfection. And it ends with, I have a website.
Okay. I was going to ask if I would know it when I saw it.
You'll know it.
Okay.
You'll know it. It's a little off the beaten path. Yeah. It's on like the second or third floor.
Okay.
You might have to get some powers before you can go back there.
Written by someone who clearly has experience with.
I have a website. I will let the people know.
I want you to read it.
Yeah, I think it was written by River Norquist.
The less said about that, the better.
Yeah.
Probably.
It's about smoking. It's a weird letter.
It smelled like strawberry. It was weird.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, should we just jump right into it and do some?
Yeah.
If you have questions.
Yes.
You can email them. Not you. You know how to get questions.
I mean, I could.
You can just ask me.
Are you saying I can't?
But,
am I legally forbidden from submitting a question to this podcast?
If you want to send an email, then you can.
Okay.
The email address.
Let's hope it doesn't come to that.
I mean, I hope we can just send like a Discord message or something. But yeah, the email address is techpod@content.town.
Yes.
That's techpod@content.town.
That's where these questions came.
All of them.
To you?
Yeah.
Shall I dive right in?
I think that's a good idea.
Got a few emails here. Here's the first one.
Okay.
From Alex in St. Paul, Minnesota. In regards to the iPhone discussions you guys had at the beginning of the pod. Do you think that Touch ID will make a comeback with a future iPhone?
Ooh.
I really like using the function for my phone and just thought that Face ID was a silly thing. Also, in regards to TVs, what's the difference between OLED and QLED? Is there one? Thanks for the podcast.
That's a I don't know if we should allow two-parters.
That's
a good question.
I already threw them both out
there. Okay, so we got to answer it.
As someone who's not a big fan of the direction that Apple phones have gone in.
Yeah, I know you don't like the notch.
I know the notch is not exactly directly Touch ID related, but I feel like they're of a piece.
I like
the change. All the changes happened at the same time. Therefore, I associate them all negatively.
I've been keeping
an eye on this subject is what I'm trying to get at.
So you think they're going to do Touch ID? Well, I mean, there's Android phones where you can get a fingerprint sensor through
it's
the screen
out there
already.
Now. I didn't even realize that. And I sometimes feel a little bad that this is a pretty Apple centric podcast. That's just the ecosystem that we happen to be in.
Look, I touched a Pixel 4 the other day.
Yeah.
I didn't catch on fire or anything.
I'm not averse to it. It's just, you know, there's a lot of legacy here at this point.
The big problem is my wife has an iPhone and is really committed to it. And that means I also have an iPhone and I'm really committed to it.
Wait a minute. It's almost like they planned it that way.
I bought a Pixel 2 when the Pixel 2 came out, and Gina got so pissed off at me because I all the group text messages just went right into the ether.
She's like, damn it, your text messages are green instead of blue now. Fuck you.
It's not even that. It's if you were in a group with five. Anyway, yeah, off topic.
Also, not to really get off topic, but you have done the migration from an iPhone.
Yeah, it was great.
Getting off of iMessage is one of the most bizarre processes I have ever been through. Cause I used
an Android phone. Now
have they got it? Made it better?
Yeah. Now there's a website. You just go put your thing. You go into your iCloud account and you say forever disassociate my phone number from iMessage. And then it just works.
Cause it used to be, there was no real manual way to shut it down.
And you had to call.
And apparently people would continue sending you iMessages for like a week to 2 weeks. And they would just vanish into the ether without any feedback to the sender that you weren't actually getting the messages.
Yeah.
Like, how many friendships did that ruin? Responding to my... Anyway.
Yeah. Okay, greenie.
So, yeah, I had been... I looked around at phone rumors here and there. And that actually has been a kind of big rumor about new iPhones in the last month or two, is that this under-screen thumbprint reading technology.
Okay.
In-screen
readers. There's no button.
Right.
It's just there's a circle on the screen that you put your finger in and it scans it or something.
I feel like I saw some of the rumors said it might be maybe not the entire screen, but at least enough of it.
Portion.
That you don't need to hit like a very specific defined area.
That's nice.
There's a lot of talk that may make it into next year's iPhones.
It seems like a no-brainer for iPads. Because everything, the iPad Pros, the newer iPad Pros have Face ID.
Yes.
But the older, just plain iPads still have a home button.
Right.
It seems like it'd be really nice. Like, it's really hard for me using an iPhone 10 and getting used to the swipe from the bottom to grab the iPad because nothing works the same way anymore.
At the same time, I don't know. It seems like we might be a few years away from it just making its way into the entire product line. Because one of the rumors going around right now is that, they've established this iPhone and iPhone Pro framework, right? It sounds like the in-screen thumbprint stuff might be a pro-only feature for the first year.
I would think it would be the other way. I think the Face ID is the upsell, right?
I think so.
You don't have to touch anything.
I think if you want both, you're going to have to pay.
I mean,
that's the rumor.
The nice thing about Face ID, which doesn't apply to us, but when I was in Chicago last year and it was 18 degrees below zero and I didn't want to take my glove off long enough to put my thumb on the thing.
That's maybe an edge case, but it's a pretty good one.
It was great, except for I also had a scarf and a hat on, so Face ID didn't work either. So
you shouldn't be using your phone in cold like that anyway.
The battery life went really bad.
Yeah.
I knew.
Yeah. So you might get your wish.
There's a patent.
Yeah. Also, I in the course of looking into this, I saw Apple bought a small startup that specializes in this kind of technology a few years ago.
I can't even imagine what that pitch. Like, when you go to the VCs to raise money for that, are you like, look, I am really passionate about thumbprints
through screens
and I want to not, and I hate buttons.
Yep.
I hate physical sensors. Yes. So we're going to devote the next 3 years and get a bunch of really smart material scientists to figure this thing out.
Right place, right time.
And then Apple rolls out Face ID like 2 weeks later and your whole pitch meeting goes to shit.
The right idea at the right time.
Ugh.
Could be pretty lucrative, but it sounds like next year or maybe the year after you might get your wish on this stuff.
That sounds good.
So yeah,
more options, better.
Yeah, totally.
The QLED versus OLED thing is a real good question.
Yeah.
OLED is an organic light emitting diode, and QLED is just a marketing term made up by Samsung that sounds like OLED.
Yeah, man, TV marketing is so...
Yeah.
I don't know if it's like trite or cliched to...
Quantum dots.
...to grouse about the way the TVs are named and marketed and stuff at this point, but it's really bad.
Look,
QLEDs are just LCDs. Like, they're nice LCDs.
They're LCDs with better backlights.
They're like massively improved and evolved over what LCDs were 10 years ago.
Yeah. But
fundamentally, it's still the same screen.
The thing that the QLED stuff does, as I understand, is that they do better blocking. So there's less bleed through and you get slightly better black levels, but it's still not like OLED when it's generating black is absence of light.
Right.
QLED when it's generating black is still just blocking light and maybe turning off some backlight.
Right. Like, that's the fundamental difference, right? Is that OLED is self-emissive. The pixels emit their own light.
Yeah.
LCDs are not. So they require a backlight. And then when you have to shine a backlight through, that's when you get the bleed and the poor black levels because you're shining a light through
It's less of a problem.
Now. Yeah. It sounds like that stuff has gotten way better.
Yeah.
Like, actually, honestly, every time we go to Costco or something and I walk by, I'm not trying to denigrate QLED at all. Like, it looks pretty damn good.
It's a really good looking LCD.
Yeah. Somebody whose last LCD TV was bought in like 2008 or something. Like, I'm kind of amazed at how good that tech still looks. Well, it's more just the naming is so opportunistic.
It's shitty.
Yeah. It's really dumb.
The thing about, it's just really, it's their high end LCD.
Yeah.
That's the takeaway.
Yeah. Still probably the most cost effective option, I would guess, on the market for like size to price and so forth.
Oh, LCD,
like,
for sure.
I know OLED is getting cheaper, but the QLED stuff, or no, of course QLED is just Samsung, right?
QLED is just Samsung. So the OLED stuff is, you still pay a huge premium for.
Yeah.
Like it's when you're talking about being able to go out and buy a $700 55 inch LCD TV,
you're not going
to
get that.
No, it's going to be $2,000, $1,800 still for the same size OLED. Yeah.
So like, I would guess that, I don't know what other manufacturers call quantum dot or modern LCD stuff. Like, I guess they all have their own.
They just call it LCD.
QLED is not a
backlit LCD.
God, isn't there another term they use for? Well, actually, just calling TVs LED TVs in the first place is kind of misleading.
Well, that was when they changed the backlights from cold cathode to LED. You get big power savings. Yes. And the big benefit of LED backlights, if they did them right, they didn't for a long time, but now they do, is that they could selectively turn off the backlight in the dark parts.
Right.
So you do actually get true black rather than transmissively blocked black.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, like LCDs, LEDs, whatever you want to call them, are probably still your best bang for the buck option.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
If
a Pico LED projector and a shoebox that's painted white inside.
Okay.
And then you cut two holes. You put the Pico LED projector on the bottom.
All right.
And you cut two holes and you just hold it up to your face.
Wow.
And it looks like an 80 inch that's really, TV screen.
It's really doing a lot with a little.
Look, it's like a very little projector.
Yeah.
Don't do that for the record.
Hey, you could.
I'm not
going to stop anybody.
Yeah, no, go for it. If you have a Pico LED projector and some shoes, use that box.
Yeah, give it a shot. Do you want to hear about Michael from Omaha's Jeep?
I love Jeeps and I love Michael from Omaha. So, yes. Hi, Michael from Omaha.
I'm not willing to take that leap just yet.
He seems okay.
He seems like a friendly guy.
Yeah, I read this email. He has a Jeep. He can't be bad.
Yes. He's writing in about the recent episode we did about autonomous vehicles.
Oh, yes.
He says, I recently bought a 2019 Jeep Cherokee Upland.
Oh, is it haunted?
Oh, I don't know.
Does it have autonomy?
What?
Is it like a ghost car?
No, I think it's the opposite.
Oh.
He says, this is my first financial ball and chain post-college, and I'm surprised to report that there is no autonomy in this car at all.
Wow.
There's no lane assist, adaptive cruise, or even blind spot monitoring. Now, there are obviously features I prefer to have. For instance, this car isn't even keyless.
What? I didn't think they made cars with keys anymore.
Like, is that really that widespread?
I haven't had a rail car that had a key in 2 years, probably.
No kidding.
Yeah.
But I am happy to have a more manual experience with this car. In rural Iowa and Nebraska, I can't really believe that all of the assist features would be too useful. And I am absolutely not familiar or comfortable with them. Like you guys said, rural America is a whole different beast than the coasts when it comes to autonomous vehicles and the like.
Yeah.
So, okay. There's still full on mechanical ass car. Well, whatever. There have to be microchips in that car doing something somewhere.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like fuel injectors and stuff like that. Like there's cruise control,
but,
I'm sure.
But not on a really kind of driver facing level, it sounds like, for the most part.
Well, yeah. I mean, it sounds like, so one is, I love that Jeep still makes like aggressive, like they intentionally design uncomfortable. Like if you buy a Wrangler today, it is still an uncomfortable ass car.
It's part of the experience.
Yeah. It's what you're paying money for that.
Keeps you alert.
Yeah. It sounds like there's no fly-by-wire stuff in this car.
Okay.
And like, if you look at it, I don't think we talked about this last 2 weeks ago.
No, but it was something you had in the notes the very little I've read about like aviation and airline disasters and stuff like that. Like fly-by-wire is a term you see a lot.
Yeah. So
it's kind of an interesting concept.
So there's, as with all of this stuff, there's gradations in like degree, and at the most aggressive level, I think the F-16 is fly-by-wire in that, the joystick that controls the flight stick that controls the thing and the pedals that control the rudders and the throttle aren't actually like in the old days, you'd push the throttle forward and it'd pull one of those cords with the wire inside it. And that would
right.
pull a throttle linkage inside the engine. That would put more gas.
Right,
into
like
the
you're,
back of the
you
plane.
Are, you're mechanically operating a sequence of moving parts,
yes.
right? That tangibly from like your input to whatever happens is all sort of physically connected. Right?
Yes. With fly by wire, those things are connected to sensors that send electrical impulses through to the thing that does the actuation. So, and there's varying levels in between. So like in cars, I think I read that electrics and hybrids usually have some degree of like mechanical assisted, sorry, they're fly-by-wire unless the power goes out, and then there's a mechanical assist that hits a hydraulic thing that triggers like a pump that pumps hydraulic fluid into the brakes so that you can stop the car.
So that's just a safety fallback.
If the 12-volt power conks out in your car and it was pure fly-by-wire, you have no brakes. You'd
be in trouble.
It's bad.
Yeah.
Nobody wants that.
Yeah.
So yeah, like with that, you hit, when you press the pedal hard enough, it actuates a pump, and the pump pumps hydraulic fluid into the brakes, which makes them stop.
Oh, is that just a pressure thing? Even if the power is on, if you jam the brake hard enough, that
don't know
kicks
if
in?
Okay. I don't know if you can hit the brake hard enough when the power is on.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
It seems like, I want to say that Toyota and Ford and Mazda, maybe, who I think does design share with Ford sometimes, all had used the same system for that.
Interesting. Okay.
And then on pure electric cars, it's the same situation because you do adaptive regeneration on the brakes for hybrids and electric cars. So you need fly-by-wire. But like at a lesser level, anti-lock brakes are similar to that in that they take an input from you pushing the pedal down. And remember when you might be too young, but when I was a kid, they were told us to pump the brakes if you ever had to really stop hard. And the anti-lock brakes just does that pumping for you in a controlled way based on input from sensors and the road.
I think that was a little before my time.
Like just probably just like 2 years.
Yeah.
But yeah, so the takeaway is don't pump anti-lock brakes. This is an old person problem. same thing, but like the steering wheel and stuff.
I was going to ask.
Wire in a lot of
cars. I was going to ask is power steering a more rudimentary, or is that a hydraulic system?
Power steering is a hydraulic assist.
Okay.
To make it easier to turn the wheel, but there are more fly by wire, like a Tesla wheel. I don't think is connected to the linkage that drives the front that turns the front of the car. I could be wrong on that.
I would believe that.
Yeah,
about Tesla.
You can turn the wheel. You can use the steering wheel to control the games in the center console.
Maybe not the best idea.
Well, you gotta kill some time while you're charging.
Do they have more games? Do they have more than Cuphead in there?
It's like Cuphead. There's a racing game.
Such a weird game to start with. Why Cuphead of all games?
Probably because it runs on the Tegra, because it's a Tegra chip in the dash. I mean, if you think about all the stuff that runs on NVIDIA hardware. It has to be something that fits into that weird aspect ratio.
It's such a weird retro lo-fi thing to play in your weird future battery car with a giant screen.
It's a pretty modern design on a retro lo-fi game.
It's a good looking game. Don't get me wrong.
I didn't know you hate Cuphead too. All the things you hated last week I love.
I don't hate Cuphead. All right. It's
okay.
It's a little hard.
It's too hard for me. I can't play it.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Here is an email from John in Texas.
Hi, John.
About things we didn't enjoy because they never existed. He says, vaporware has existed forever and is one of the things that I have always found interesting, be it software or hardware. There's even more of it now that things like Indiegogo and Kickstarter exist, although now they are cracking down on those kinds of things. But what is your favorite all-time vaporware? It can either be something that was announced or that you heard about from, quote, sources.
Half-Life 3.
I don't know. Does that count?
They never announced it. Half-Life 3, Episode 3.
I think they said the words Half-Life 2, Episode 3, right? That was promised.
Half-Life 2, Episode 3.
Episode
2 ends on a cliffhanger.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure they said at the outset there would be three of them.
Yes, and then there never was.
I think Episode 3 does count as vaporware. I don't know that Half-Life 3 does, though, unless you want to get into things you've heard.
I haven't heard anything.
No?
Well, okay. Maybe. I don't know.
Sounds like a dangerous topic.
I don't know that there is vaporware anymore.
Yeah, we were really talking about this before the show, trying to come up with some examples.
To lift the curtain, Brad.
Like, obviously, Duke Nukem Forever is the kind of classic, the example.
It took so long to make that by the time it came out, it was irrelevant on two different fronts, both the content and the game design.
Yep, and the technology.
Yeah. Three fronts then, yeah.
There's not that much of this stuff in my mind these days, I feel like.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. Like the Phantom from back... You remember the Phantom? That comes to mind.
That was on the Wikipedia list of famous vaporware.
Oh, was it really? I didn't even look at that.
They finally released the Lapboard.
The Lapboard was like the interesting tech part of that thing, I think, and that did come out.
People
didn't hate it.
People sell those. Like Corsair sells a thing that's Lapboards. Like that. Well, yeah, it's like you can jam one of their mechanical keyboards into...
Yeah.
And then it's like got a Bluetooth radio or something, and you plug it in, and it's wireless. I feel like maybe games don't get announced early enough to Like by the time a game gets announced, it's pretty much going to come out.
Yeah.
Unless it's like an NBA game.
Like game software, I feel like, is not great in this category these days. I do have a little bit of a fascination with some of the kind of middle period console boxes that got announced and didn't really go anywhere. Like the Phantom is one. The Nuon.
Oh, yeah. I remember that one.
Like the Apple Pippin, which I think did make it to market.
Really?
Barely.
Oh.
Or I think you can get them, right?
Do you remember the 3Com Audrey? This is one of my favorites.
The what?
The 3Com Audrey was a hub.
It took me a minute to remember what 3Com was.
3Com made modems and also the Palm Pilot.
Yeah, right.
And it was a hub for the Palm Pilots.
Okay.
So like, imagine you,
the Audrey,
your partner, and your child all had Palm Pilots. Of course. You needed a way to sync the schedules across all those devices. You could come up and plug your palms into the Audrey.
Is that their attempt?
And it had a little screen.
Okay.
And you could, it would have the shared calendar on it.
Is that their attempt at the Lisa?
No, it was more of an embedded thing. I mean, just naming. They were definitely trying to, it was very friendly.
Yeah.
It was white and blue plastic.
Sure. Okay.
And like it looked like you could hold it in your hands.
I believe that.
It was nice.
I was trying to think of some other examples from just the computing world, like
WebOS.
Well, that came out. I still have a functional HP touchpad around here somewhere.
Well, and it has
WebOS on it.
It's also the heart of all the LG smart TVs now.
I saw that.
I thought
that was strange. Like, did they buy WebOS from HP?
Yeah, they bought from HP.
Huh. Yeah. Was that thing actually like good and robust enough to be worth acquiring?
Yeah.
Like, I thought it was okay.
Well, but like,
I see people talk about it in like kind of loving terms that I don't fully understand because I don't know what's so unique about it.
It did a lot of the stuff that Android was good at the time,
okay,
but iOS was bad at like multitasking.
Okay.
And it did them in ways that were designed that were more Apple-y.
Huh. Would you say it was just a little ahead of its time?
It was kind of like BOS.
Okay.
It was kind of an alternative path that phones could have taken.
With some good ideas. Good ideas executed well. Good implementation.
With terrible marketing at the wrong time in the cycle.
And does LG just own the whole thing now?
I don't have any idea. I think LG bought the OS and I don't know what happened. Or maybe they just license it. I don't know.
Do you have a lot of hands-on time with their newer TVs? I wonder how that stuff is.
I've used Gary and Norm's TVs a little bit. It seems really good. Like,
is the
Gary? Neither of them have Apple TVs hooked up anymore.
Oh wow! They just use the TV,
or
stuff?
They just use the Apple TVs for Apple stuff.
Built-in.
Yeah, that Norm says the built-in stuff is good.
Like, I guess how smart the smart stuff in TVs is like a whole episode unto itself at this point. But it's been so long, so like my TV was bought in 2012, I think. Like, it's very outdated at this point. So, like, I don't really have much of a sense of how good the embedded
apps in our TVs were bad when they were brand new.
Yes, they're unusable.
Same thing for my. I have a 2008. I have like a 38-inch 2008 Vizio, and it's not.
It's good. Horrendous.
My sister-in-law has a TV that has a Roku built in. That's awesome.
Okay,
it's same era.
Yeah.
So it was like $100. Yeah,
actually, my parents got a $250. TCL over the holidays last year that has the Roku stuff built in.
It's great.
Totally fine.
Yeah. So like I think we reached the point where it's good enough.
You're just going to get like a halfway decent ARM chip in there. That's probably really good stuff.
Probably fine.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't know. I don't think anything, on the hardware side, we didn't talk about Kickstarter because Kickstarter is a lot of stuff gets kickstarted. But I don't think that counts as vaporware since you're basically taking, like, Kickstarter makes it really clear that you're taking a gamble when you back a Kickstarter now.
Yeah.
So I feel like that maybe doesn't count.
It feels like a different category of undelivered product to me.
Yeah.
Kind of, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Like I backed, when I was at Tested, we backed a Virtuix Omni, the VR treadmill.
It's okay.
It looks like a disc that you wear special shoes on. You slide around.
I feel like people have been trying that for so long.
I've used one. It's bad.
Like I remember seeing something along those lines at an E3 like 15 to 20 years ago.
So we backed this in, I don't know, it was before the DK1 came out probably.
Okay.
And I got the fulfillment email after I'd already left Tested in 2015. And I sent it to Norm and I don't think he even bothered to fill it in because... Yeah, we're fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The only other thing I thought of was like, I was trying to think about like operating system level stuff. Like, didn't Vista have some promised features that
Well, they've restarted Vista twice, is my understanding.
Yeah, that's, but I feel like, I want to say there were features promised for Vista that not only didn't make it into Vista, but have never materialized, period. Oh,
the file system.
That's the one, that was the big one that I was thinking of.
It was a database-based file system. Yeah, I don't remember what they called it.
It was, but there was a fair amount of hype around it, and I don't quite remember why, but the reason it stands out to me is that not only did they not get that component into Vista, but then now we're still on NTFS. How, like, what is it?
Well, we're newer versions of
12 years. Well, yeah, obviously they've been iterating on it, but.
So the big deal with the Longhorn file system, WinFS is what it was called.
Okay.
Was that it was based on a relational database. So instead of storing stuff in blocks on the drive, you'd have basically a database layer. Yeah. It added an additional layer between the metal of the drive.
Right. Which I think is somewhat, or to some extent, is how ZFS works.
It's kind of how ZFS works.
Not quite the same, but.
Yeah. The goal was to make it searchable.
Okay.
So. If you remember, in Windows XP, almost all of us had installed some garbage utility, including the thing built by Microsoft, that would index and scan the hard drive. And it took a ton of overhead because it was constantly like scraping and looking, and you couldn't even really search inside documents. The thing that happened was, so the idea was, rather than storing everything in like containers like we do now, so like a Word docx is a zip file, or it may not be a zip, but it's like a slightly compressed file with an XML file inside that describes the contents of the file,
right? And you have to
and all the attachments inside, right, inside the container.
And reading that on a per file basis, you have to deal with IO constraints and stuff. It's just not it's not very efficient.
Yeah. So the upshot was the idea was we would just store the files in the database, but it turns out it's just easier to make an XML file that has that information in it, and then let the teach the scraper how to scrape through that stuff.
I see.
Yeah.
So
that's my guess. I don't know if that's correct, but that's my assumption.
Well, it definitely seems like NTFS is here to stay for a while.
I think NTFS.
At
yeah.
this point.
Like it would be nice to add journaling and stuff like that to NTFS.
What does journaling do? I think I feel like on a practical level, it's one of the things that lets you survive like a power failure, right?
And not lose
any data.
Yeah.
But I don't know how it works.
Exactly. I don't know how it works. It has to do with, basically it keeps a record of all the writes and reads, is my understanding.
I see.
Yeah. So you can go back and recreate changes if you lose stuff.
Okay. All right, Will.
Yeah.
Here it is. Here's a first.
Okay.
For this podcast.
Yes.
We have our first anonymous email.
Oh man.
This information is too hot to identify the source.
I hope this isn't about pooping.
No.
Okay, that's good.
Arguably more disturbing.
Is it not about that. 80s music either, is
nope,
it?
Nope, okay. Definitely not that. That's,
all these are good.
It is about a person writing in whose significant other is involved in what I'm going to dub the Costco chicken industrial complex.
What? This is not at all where I expected this to go.
I know. This is
except
this,
for we did talk about it before the show.
This email definitely is sort of making me question what this podcast is actually about.
I like that they're getting this information out here.
When did we even, was this during the food episode a few weeks ago?
One of my favorite ideas is that the geological definition of our time is going to be microplastics and chicken bones.
Okay. Oh, right. Yes. I think we talked about that.
And we talked so a million years from now when the aliens or like the insect descendants that have gone sentient are digging up to find out what was on the earth before, they'd be like, it's weird. There's like a 3-inch layer here that's just all plastic beads and chicken bones.
Tiny fossilized bones.
These strangely evolved birds that can barely walk. And yeah, anyway.
Well, this email should help demystify where some of those bones are coming from.
Is this going to make me a vegetarian?
I don't know. Probably not. It's okay. It's kind of more stats and figures, which are themselves pretty eye-opening.
Popeye's just got the chicken sandwich back. I haven't
gotten to try that thing yet.
It's pretty good. It's, you know, it's no Bojangles.
Yeah, well, that would be hard.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
This person says, first off, the operation is centered in Fremont, Nebraska and the surrounding area.
That's pretty specific.
My significant other is just about to start raising chickens for Costco, so I know a thing or two about the whole setup.
Oh boy.
First, there are three types of operations. One will raise the chickens to be consumed, that is, receive them at a week old and raise them for 44 days.
Okay.
This is what my significant other is doing. One raises chicks to be mothers. That one is a cycle of a few months.
Is that like an egg situation?
I guess so.
Okay.
Well, you raise the chicken or the chick to maturity so it can start laying.
Okay.
And finally, you can farm the mother's eggs and incubate them.
Oh.
My significant other is farming the, quote, broilers, the chickens that will be consumed. She will receive 400,000 chickens every 2 months.
Sweet, merciful Jeebus.
She raised... I don't even...
Is it like...
The logistics of I can't.
How many chickens can you fit in an 18 wheeler?
I don't. That's like that. I feel like that starts getting into like ethics of food territory that I'm hard uncomfortable. Okay,
keep reading. I'm going to Google.
Okay. She'll receive 400,000 chickens every 2 months. She raises them for 44 days, and then she has a 2 week break in between.
I assume that's just shoveling chicken shit out of the.
Probably.
Ugh.
This is the smallest scale broiler operation available with 4 barns.
What?
There are also 8 and 12 barn operations. So it's possible to.
That would be 12. 1.2 million chickens.
It is possible to raise 1.2 million chickens in a single farming operation.
Oh my God. I was joking about the chicken layer.
Every 2 months.
But wow.
If we do the math, also, yeah, he puts it into perspective here. If we do the math, roughly 400,000 chickens minimum every 2 months. That's roughly 2.4 million a year. This is just out of the operation that he's associated with. Now, I don't know how many total operations there are, but there's one other farm near us in eastern Nebraska doing this who is building 12 barns. I guess that means he's at 7.2 million chickens per year. Perhaps even crazier is that Costco is only intending on replacing 40% of their $5 chickens with this operation. That sort of leads into the last thing I wanted to mention, that Costco is really doing right by farmers with this operation. Typically, chicken farming contracts are the most notorious anti-farmer contracts out there. Costco, however, has guaranteed pay through... Oh, I'm sorry. I misread that. Costco has guaranteed pay, though, along with some incentive-based goals.
Oh, that's good.
Most importantly, since they're only aiming to supplement 40% of their chickens with this operation, they could lose half of their chicken consumers and still keep these farmers employed, which isn't something you can say with most other animal contracts besides hogs. But since Costco's chicken sales have increased year over year for the past decade, I don't know if there's much risk of the bottom dropping out.
According to the internet, you can fit about at least 5,000 chickens into an 18 wheeler.
Wow. What?
Yeah.
What's the square foot?
I didn't look
size of an 18. Like, it can't be that much, right?
Chickens are pretty small, Brad.
5,000 chickens in a single. You're talking a single trailer.
Right? I found an article about a chicken trailer overturning and more than 5,000 chickens getting loose.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
Man, those.
That's a lot of chickens.
Those Costco. I'm not on the take from Costco here or anything, but those Costco chickens are really good.
I don't think I've ever had one.
They're very good.
When we get with our food item at Costco is to get the $8 pizza or whatever it is.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, the chicken is.
The pizza's. Look, when I was at Future, our office was right down the street from a Costco, and that was a fairly regular lunch option.
Yeah, of course. Oh, come on. I mean, you're like relatively young and working in the tech press. There's going to be a lot of pizza consumed.
Yeah. Like we would often on crunch week, we would send like, you know, two people to go out and get four or five pizzas. Yeah. And
I get it.
I like that better than a Little Caesars Hot and Ready.
You know, a rotisserie chicken, maybe not most appropriate office environment eating.
I mean, it's a little hard. What do you do with your rotisserie? Do you just eat them plain?
That's the thing. They're so versatile. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. A lot of the time we'll just pull the breast off and heat it in a pan and just eat it as is.
We'll do that.
But I mean, you name it, man. Like just about anything you can do with chicken, you can.
I usually take the breasts off and we'll eat them for like dinner with some potatoes or Brussels or something. And then
a proper roaster.
Yeah.
A broiler.
And then the rest of it, I'll chop the meat off of and turn it into chicken salad.
Yeah. Chicken salad like or chicken soup.
Yeah. You can put the carcass in.
Yes. We make stock with the carcass on occasion. That's the good stuff.
Yeah.
But those chickens, the Costco chickens are amazingly juicy and succulent.
It's funny. So Amazon/Whole Foods does a loss leader chicken now that's I think like $8. That's very good.
Okay, I believe it.
I wonder what the cost is.
Eight is more than five, though. I've got
it is more, but also they deliver is the thing.
Okay, that's fair.
Because you know,
broilers right to your door.
Our dystopian nightmare world. Yeah. Holy shit!
Yeah,
400,000 every 40 days.
That's a lot of chickens.
That's a bunch of chickens.
That's a terrifying number of chickens.
I can't imagine why it needs 2 weeks downtime in between. That's the thing that's the scariest part of this to me.
Yeah, it's not.
Yeah.
It's just.
I'm glad. There were a bunch of chicken barns by the around the corner from my house when I was a kid, but they did not hold 400,000 chickens.
I think we've reached the limits of what we need to know about this chicken operation.
Yeah, if
we're going to continue consuming chicken.
I need to not talk about this anymore.
That's fair. All right, Will.
Hey, Brad.
I'm not going to refer this refer to this as a correction.
We don't do corrections on podcasts. That's how you ruin podcasts.
Let's say this is providing additional context.
I love more context.
We're expanding on something we talked about previously.
Is this about the rice?
Well, we'll get to that.
Okay.
This is about, this is from Kush.
Hey, Kush.
On a recent podcast, you mentioned that you had a recommendation for an external USB SSD for use with a NAS. However, now I can't find it in the show notes or on Twitter. Mm. Can you post the recommendation again?
So in the world of additional context, I mistook a inexpensive USB SSD for an inexpensive SATA SSD.
Okay.
I bought a Kingston 120 gigabyte A400 2.5 inch internal SSD.
So this is like
for $21.99.
Wow. So this is standard laptop size, standard just internal
SSDs, SSD, no NVMe, nothing fancy,
right. And just bare SATA ports on the drive.
Bare SATA
standard,
ports,
as standard as it gets.
I plugged it into the internal SATA headers in the drive because I was going through two or three USB thumb drives a year, even though I was buying kind of nice thumb drives.
I am having exactly the same experience.
Yeah, they're not. Thumb drives are not designed to be on and written to all the time.
Using them as a system drive, despite what the FreeNAS community would have you believe, is maybe not the most reliable.
Yeah.
Use case for cheapo USB thumb drive.
So if your motherboard has yellow SSD ports on it, those are special
SATA ports.
SATA ports. Those are special USB ports. They are called SATA DOM ports. You can use them like normal SSD drives, but they provide power to small SSDs.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So you can get like
DOM looks
like
is a, what disk on module, I think.
Yeah. And it's basically like a little dongle that looks like it's a little bit bigger than a USB thumb drive. And you can plug those, one of those, you don't have to provide power into a USB SATA port and it'll just work.
Interesting.
And that's the other option if you don't want to get a full 2.5 inch SSD. You don't need 120 gigabytes for FreeNAS.
Ooh.
You need like that 8 or something at this point, maybe 16.
I think a fresh install boot environment is like a few hundred megabytes.
I think they recommend 16 gigabytes.
They do recommend a space because it snapshots previous versions, so you can always roll back if you need to.
It fills up.
The big thing for me is I like to run a mirrored install drive or boot drive, just in case.
I stopped doing that when I put the SSD in.
SSD is probably going to be fine by itself, but like I just like the additional security, and that's easier to get with USB.
Yeah, that's it.
But anyway, so look for that.
Yeah. Kingston A400. It doesn't matter. I went with Kingston because they're reasonably reliable and they had a lot of ratings on iTunes, on Amazon, and they were, it was $20.
That's fine.
I was spending that much in SSDs twice a year.
I sympathize with him because I got all excited too about the idea of a drive that would plug straight into the USB header.
You could get an external SSD that's just USB
plugs into the USB.
You have to put a header in and then you have to plug it. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had bought one of the SATA DOM drives and had to send it back because my motherboard didn't have yellow ports.
No way to externally power it.
It was easier to just plug in a normal SSD.
Sure. Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Speaking of additional context.
I love additional context.
This one is from Jonathan.
Oh, hi, Jonathan.
He says, you can use the wrong slash in Windows to change directories if you use PowerShell rather than the command prompt.
Oh, this is a shout out to our last questions episode.
Yes. You can also use some other Linux commands and I believe syntax. So, for instance, ls works instead of for.
Yes.
Sorry, I'm not much of a Linux user. The last version I really used was Red Hat 4. So.
Oh, and this person also found a worse monitor than yours.
Oh, gosh, let's not. Let's stick to the command prompt
stuff. It appears to be very thick. I've never seen one like this
before,
Brad.
The thing that he's talking to you about, not me.
So
yes, he's got a large CRT.
It's like a 19-inch CRT. Wow, I remember.
It's a gold star monitor.
I had a gold star. I bought those for offices when I installed computers.
Isn't that the precursor to LG?
No, that's.
Doesn't LG stand for Lucky Gold Star?
Oh, it does stand for Lucky Gold Star. You're right.
Yeah.
The other place you can use slash it's the wrong way is in File Explorer. Okay. Somebody on Twitter pointed that out.
Okay.
So it's only the CMD program that they have to be the right way.
I see.
But in PowerShell, which is like it replaced the POSIX extensions, I think, for Windows. And File Explorer, you can do whichever way you want.
I am one of the 8 lunatics out there who will type into File Explorer, so that's good to know.
I type into File Explorer. Yeah. You should look. There's so many keyboard shortcuts. And
if Yeah.
Did you know you can just press the Windows key and type the name of the thing you want to launch and it just opens?
I do that every day.
The best. Did you know you can press Windows key plus one and it'll open the first program on your taskbar?
I did know that.
Did you know you can press Windows key plus four and it opens the fourth program on your taskbar?
I knew that too. Well, by the associative property.
So you can press Windows plus P and it will change which monitors are active?
Yes, I use that all the time.
I use that one a lot.
With my 30-foot HDMI cable.
God damn it.
I used to be weirdly anti-keyboard shortcut. I don't know why.
Why would you be anti-keyboard shortcut?
And by used to, I mean like 20 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
I mean like back in the 90s or whatever.
Well, they weren't super useful.
Yeah, well, maybe they've gotten a lot better, but my attitude was very much just like, why would I want to learn a bunch of keyboard shortcuts when I can just point at things with a mouse?
Yeah. And then you got old and your wrist started hurting.
Well, not only that, but I was like, oh, if I memorize keyboard shortcuts, I can get around 10 times faster.
Yeah.
Actually, moving to a Mac is what did it.
Mm.
I think 2008 is when I bought my first MacBook.
Yeah.
So I hadn't like next to no OS X experience before that.
Oh, but Mac does a good OS X surprisingly does a pretty good job of exposing the keyboard shortcuts in the menus because that's part of their design guidelines.
Yeah. And just kind of providing a lot of very useful ones.
So that's good.
I got used to the concept then, and then I feel like Windows has gotten a lot better about providing good ones.
I feel like then. Yeah, when they first added the Windows key in that context menu, that those two keys to the keyboard, like what 15 years ago now with Windows XP, 19 years ago with Windows XP, they didn't use those keys for anything good. And then around the time Windows 7 or Vista came out, they started at like Windows plus L locks the computer. Yep.
Windows E opens a file explorer window.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah, I did know. Windows Tab is a good one because it opens the multiple.
Yes.
Like if you get in a situation where a game or something has crashed and you can't get Alt Tab to work, Windows plus Tab will let you go to the next desktop over, open Task Manager, kill the thing that's broken, and then switch back.
Even if you're not using multiple desktops, I think Windows plus Tab is a better Alt Tab anyway.
Actually,
I guess that's really only true if you are using. Well, I guess because it does more of an OS X expose style of showing you window previews.
Yeah.
Instead of just a little bar of icons and stuff.
Yeah.
I think that's just a better way to switch in general.
Windows plus. And when we say multiple desktops, we don't mean multiple monitors. We mean multiple virtual desktops.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I believe Windows X opens a command prompt or PowerShell.
Yeah, that's right.
There's another one for you.
I think it's. I'd have to have a Windows computer in front of me to confirm, but yes.
Okay. Yeah.
It's a really good, additional context.
Yes, we've really expanded on those topics.
I know. What a great job!
Completely accurate about from the very beginning.
Nailed it from the start.
Sticking with the old computer stuff here for a bit. Here's a question from Steve. When I was a kid, I got the notion that we needed to upgrade our 66 megahertz 486, and somehow convinced my dad to buy in. We didn't get a new Pentium, though. We got a 100 megahertz 586, which we somehow Frankensteined into the existing motherboard. My question is, how did I do this? I'm definitely the one that did most of the physical smashing together of parts, and I realize as an adult, I have no idea how that actually worked. My internet searching has come up woefully short. So wasn't there, like, from what I remember, wasn't there, like, a whole cottage industry of kind of backwards compatible, like quasi 586 CPUs that got marketed as like, here's a Pentium without a Pentium, even though it's not exactly.
So do you remember when the SNES came out and everybody was like, I already have a Nintendo. Why do I need another one? This is just the same thing, but just a different shaped cartridge. This is bullshit.
The local news clips of parents complaining about that from back then are fun to find on YouTube.
So the same thing happened, like 486s were the first kind of mainstream home computers for a lot of 386s, 486s, like socket 2 and socket 3 based computers were really popular. And as a result, people bought them and thought, I got a computer.
It's now like, I own a computer.
I have a fridge.
Yeah.
I have a microwave oven. I have a computer.
Yep.
Done.
Yep.
Never have to spend money on this again.
Well, I got this computer thing covered for the next 50 years.
Yep. I'll run this one out until I die.
Yep.
And then it turns out that like 6 months later, 16 new processors came out. Windows 95 hit and all those old computers were garbage.
Yeah.
Straight in the trash. There was a cottage industry, Cyrix, AMD, maybe not AMD, but people built either processors that would go into that socket that had more advanced instruction sets and would run at higher clock speeds at the same bus speed as the motherboard.
Meaning that they were still inherently more limited, right? Than
didn't matter then.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, they were probably
inferior not as fast to, like, as a,
if you were buying a Pentium, what would it have been? A Pentium
100? 100?
100, the first 6690, 100, 120.
There was a 66, wasn't there?
I had a 60.
Was there a 60?
Yeah, there's a 60, a 66, a 75, and a 90.
Yeah, by the time we got one, it was a 75.
Yeah, 90. And then 90 it was like 100, 120, 133, 166, 200.
Well, over time, you're right. Yeah. Not all at once.
And then the Pentium 2s hit starting at 166 and going up, and they were slots.
Yes.
So what happened was socket 7 was open. That was the last of the open sockets.
Really? Like, yeah. Not proprietary.
Because it was proprietary.
There were AMD socket 7 chips too, right?
Yeah. Okay. So K6 was a socket 7 chip.
Okay.
There were a bunch of Cyrix and those guys. And the first Pentiums were socket 4, 5, 6, 7. Maybe not 4. 3 and 4, I think, were 486. And then 5 was the Pentium 60 and through 90. And then the next rep Pentiums went into a different socket.
Right.
Anyway. You could pull a socket 7 chip out, put an AMD chip in, no problem. And they were good chips. In the 486 days, lots of times those chips were soldered on the motherboard. Mm-hmm. So what you would do is either jam something into the 487 slot socket, which was the math coprocessor socket, if it was external. Or sometimes you just have a thing that would like hump onto the old CPU and it would just like touch the leads. I don't know how it worked, but you just put it on top of the other CPU and then suddenly it was a faster computer.
So what you're saying is that he performed some variety of dark magic.
Yeah, remember the brain slugs and Futurama? It's like those before a CPU.
All right.
Those I think you had real mixed results with how well they worked, would be my guess.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
But yeah, the socket 7 stuff, that was why Intel went to the slots.
Yeah, it was a rights issue, right? Like it was not driven by technology, right?
So they were putting more cache on those packages than they could fit on a CPU. And I think the cache ran. So normally like the cache on the CPU runs at the CPU clock speed. I think that the Pentium 2 cache ran at half speed. I don't remember. But the point is they had huge cache chips inside that slot package because they could do that. And then they started releasing the Celerons, which didn't have any external cache because it turns out the cache was expensive. It didn't really do a whole lot. So they didn't need the slot for the Celerons, and they started making sockets again almost immediately.
I get warm fuzzies sitting here listening to talk of Celeron 300A and
the good
K6s and Durons and stuff like that. Was the
SL2W8.
That was the those the golden era of overclocking cheap processors to be very fast.
Yeah, you just moved a jumper and all of a sudden your 300 megahertz processor was running at 450 megahertz.
Yep.
It's good days.
And
for ages
and perfectly stable.
My all-time favorite terrible computer was the we talked about this on the throwback episode, but the A-bit BP6 powered.
Okay.
It was dual socketed. It was designed for dual socketed.
Okay.
Celeron 300s. And you could put two in, and then
this was the slot design.
This was a motherboard by the time they moved to sockets.
Back to sockets.
Yeah, so you could put two of these things in sockets on a giant ass ATX board.
Man, that's cool.
Tyann, A-bit made them and Tyann made them.
Oh, Tyann, man.
Yeah, remember Tyann? Remember A-bit?
Dude, yeah. I loved A-bit stuff. Like, yeah. I had a BH6 for so long.
BH6 was a hell of a board.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then basically nothing was designed to be multi-threaded back then. So like sound card drivers were terrible. You couldn't get your sound blaster to work usually.
What was except the for use Windows case NT. For even having more than one CPU back then?
It was really cool.
Sure.
You could encode MP3s a little bit faster, maybe.
Okay.
You could run some processes on one processor and some processes on the other processor. Okay. So you could do two things at once. It wasn't great, but it was really cool.
That was a fun time.
Yeah. Anything was possible.
Yes. Let's do a couple more here.
What you got?
Here's a question from Bert.
Hey, Bert.
About DIY music streaming. I've been using Amazon Music for streaming my library, but uploading your own songs is no longer a supported feature. Do you know of home server options to stream music remotely to Android?
Wow, I didn't know that they killed the home streaming feature. That's bogus. You can copy songs. I haven't done this in a long time. You used to be able to copy songs into Spotify directly. Okay. On your phone, like you plug it into iTunes.
And you mean locally into the Spotify client, like the app?
Yeah,
not their cloud service.
Yeah, exactly.
Like they don't have like some kind of iTunes the Match equivalent or something.
No,
like that.
No, not on the cloud service, but you could do it locally onto the phone app. But that's not what he's asking for. What he's asking for is self-hosted Spotify alternatives.
So basically, he wants to put his local music files into some kind of cloud locker and be able to stream them anywhere?
Exactly.
Okay.
There are a bunch of those. There's Funk Whale, Ampachi, which is a terrible good name. Sonar Zeh, EZH.
You're just making this up.
No, I'm not. These are according to alternative2.net, which is one of my favorite sites for finding out stuff like this. Cole, Jukesy, S2 Music, Music Folder Player, Kuzik, Melosia. Everybody who's like a CS major and wants to do an open source project seems to jam one of these out. The one I've used that's been around for a really long time is called Subsonic.
I've heard of that.
Yeah, there's plugins for FreeNAS, actually.
Okay. Maybe to back up a little bit, are any of these turnkey solutions with their own cloud storage, or are you responsible for providing your own storage for all of these?
And that's a really good question,
because I feel like that's a crucial distinction here.
I think probably you're hosting these all yourself.
Okay. Because like, I don't know if it was a Google Music or... Let's see. I'm trying to remember the litany of Google Music streaming services.
So there's Google Music. There's now, Google Play Music.
Now they're on YouTube Music.
And there's YouTube Red.
And it may have been Google Play Music, or was it Google Music? It was one of those. I mean, I can't keep them straight. But
yeah.
Anyway, Google used to have a free tier option that lets you upload.
Oh, really?
There was some huge,
like your OneDrive
or your Google Drive storage.
Yeah.
I don't know that it even took a bite out of that space. Hmm. It might have been separate, but I uploaded like my entire local library.
So I did that with Amazon Music
and was able to store it, but I think that went away too. So like, I guess everybody has just deprecated that kind of service.
I mean, look, you can probably set up a Linode or an Amazon, one of the free AWS instances and hook it up to an S3 bucket.
You can get a free AWS instance.
Yeah. There's the micros or whatever. They're very small and they're only like 4 megs of memory or something like that. But
4 megs.
It
seems insane.
4 gigs, maybe. Okay. I don't know.
Okay.
They're very small. They're micro.
But they're free?
Mostly.
Wow.
There's limits. It's like a limited trial situation.
I see.
You can work the system a little bit if you're clever.
I see.
But you'll have to pay for storage. Okay. So you'll have to pay for the S3 storage and the transfers in and out.
I see.
I mean, if you have a FreeNAS box or even like a Raspberry Pi with a big USB hard drive hooked up to it, you could easily run a Subsonic instance.
And then that's something you can stream remotely.
So yeah,
from outside of the house?
You have to be able to, like, if you know how to do the ports and all that stuff. Yeah,
so that gets into not only like opening ports and other networking stuff, but also making sure you have a good upstream with your ISP and stuff like that.
Yeah, and a way to get to the IP address at your home.
Right.
Because there's no central server that points you to those. So you'll have to either do, you know, a dynamic DNS or have a static IP address or whatever.
Yeah.
But Subsonic works really well and there's good tools for it. Plex has a music player now that's like, it's not as good as Subsonic, but if you're already running a Plex server, it's really good. I think like the neat thing about Subsonic is there's a pretty good ecosystem around it. So the last time I looked, there were 5 or 6 different iOS clients and there's probably way more Android clients. So you can hook up to your Subsonic server. And if you want something that looks like iTunes, you get something that looks like iTunes. If you want something that looks like Spotify, you get something that looks like Spotify. The thing you lose versus say a Spotify is all of those dynamic playlists that they generate that are actually pretty good. But if you just want to upload your CD collection, I would look at alternative2.net and hit the Spotify button and there's 10 in there.
Yeah. I've never heard of that site before, but it sounds pretty useful. Great.
Yeah. If you want to find obviously we know that if you want a Photoshop alternative, go to GIMP, right? Or PaintShop Pro or whatever. Jeez.
PaintShop Pro, good God.
2019 version of that is.
A blast from the past.
But it's really good for the services, for like Dropbox. If you want to learn how to host your own Dropbox and stuff like that, you can do that. Or alternatives.
You have to check that out. That sounds like a good resource.
It's a good site.
All right. I'm going to say this is our last email.
Ooh.
From Tyler in Janesville, Wisconsin. I don't know. This is a big claim.
I'm not saying hi to Tyler.
No.
It's okay.
The subject line is making a big claim here. Definitively the last rice email.
You heard that. No more emails about rice. This is also our definitively the first rice email, I think.
But yeah, I guess first and last. That's even...
It's nice that we're putting a bow on this topic.
That's even more ambitious. I hope that this can be the last email you receive about cooking rice in a pressure cooker because I have the foolproof method. I promise. There are a couple of extremely important steps that are often missed or overlooked that can make or break the outcome. But let's assume we want to make 2 cups of jasmine rice. The following is what I do. Number 1, measure 2 cups of rice and pour into a strainer. Rinse until water is clear.
Mm.
This is possibly the most important part. This keeps the rice from becoming gummy, or too sticky, as is often the complaint with pressure cooked rice. We do that around here too, even though we don't pressure cook our rice. That's okay. That's just to remove excess starch.
So like it's interesting, like sticky sushi rice.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, there's different kinds of rice first, right?
Yeah.
Jasmine is like that longer. The sushi rice is usually kind of more nodule-y.
I think you're right. Yeah. So I know there's some other stuff that happens with sushi rice after the fact.
Like they do vinegar, like,
vinegar
and, stuff,
and sugar and stuff involved. So that may have something to do with the stickiness there.
So I usually, if I'm eating with chopsticks, if I'm making a curry or something, I would eat with chopsticks. I never rinse because I really? Want it to be
you want
sticky.
It to be a little bit gummier.
But if I'm making like fried rice or something, yeah, then I always rinse.
You want a loose rice there for sure. Yeah, we need it, not just rinse.
Wow, really?
Get in there with fingertips and really kind of knead out the.
I just put it in the rice cooker and swirl it around and then I dump the water out. Too. And then when the water's clear, then I'm
that's probably good. That's probably fine. So that's step one, rinse.
I need my kale though.
Kale?
Yeah, when you make kale, if you put it in a bag with ice water and knead it, then it breaks up the cuticle and all the bitter stuff comes out.
Oh yeah.
And then you rinse all that stuff away.
Ooh, that sounds good. Step two. This is the part that got me. Use a small amount of any oil or butter.
What?
Coat the bottom of the pressure cooker container.
I feel like this is, I don't know about this.
As soon as you start talking about butter, I feel like my interest is peaked.
I like butter and I like rice.
Add the 2 cups of rice and 2 cups of water as opposed to the stovetop rice. This method requires 1-to-1 water to rice.
Okay.
Set to cook on low pressure for 12 minutes.
Hmm.
After the pressurization and 12 minutes has completed, deactivate the keep warm setting. That's in all caps.
Oh.
This is what often causes the rice to become stuck and burnt to the bottom of the container. Let the pressure manually release for 8 to 10 minutes, then quick release. Open and enjoy.
I do like a quick release.
I'm sure it depends on the model, but I didn't realize that the sort of keep warm and the depressurization were separate functions. Like, I didn't realize you necessarily would have manual control over kind of turning the heat off before the pressure is all out.
Well, so there's two things. The keep warm makes it work like a crock pot, right?
So it's just got heating, a big there's stone like a heating element underneath.
There's a heating element. There's a stone between the heating element and the stone is theoretically supposed to kind of dissipate the heat a little bit. So you don't burn your shit on the bottom of the pan. Doesn't work. The pressure comes down as the temperature decreases in the pot. So once the water starts to condense back into steam, it's like basically you do the quick release if you want to get rid of the water, the excess water. If you want the water to go back in, like if you're making soup or something, you do the slow release. And when the temperature gets low enough that the pressure goes down, it'll condense back into water. That's interesting. I'll have to try it. I'll try and report back. Yeah,
need a field report on this.
If it craps up the bottom of my pan, I'm sending it to Tyler in Wisconsin to scrape the crud off the bottom.
Maybe just use extra butter.
I don't know about this. I like the butter.
What can it hurt?
I'm pro butter, but I feel like that's going to change the rice.
Yeah, maybe so.
I'll let you know how it goes.
For the better.
Yeah.
For the more buttery.
This has been a wide ranging series of questions.
Yeah. You know.
This is
what happens on a Grab Bag Tech podcast.
This is, I like
any and all topics.
That's true. It's like my favorite Futurama episodes are their Treehouse of Horror knockoff.
Yeah.
Where they do what if machine.
They did a Treehouse of Horror knockoff?
Well, their Treehouse of Horror knockoff is the what if machine what if Farnsworth invented a machine
Is it explicitly Halloween themed or is it more just kind of whenever?
I think it's whenever.
Okay.
I think they were trying to replicate the magic of Treehouse of Horror.
They just do it the once.
Well, they did it two or three times.
Okay.
I don't know if they did in that second weird run. I feel like maybe.
Trials of Horror is the best thing The Simpsons has done to me.
Pretty consistently.
Probably. I haven't watched it in a very long time.
I usually make a point to watch Trials of Horror episodes.
I mean, there's so many of them now.
There's 25.
Oh, no. It's like more than 30 now, right?
Are they at 30 seasons?
Oh, yeah. They're past 30.
Oh, man. I'm old.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Sorry. Okay.
Yeah. I feel like I think I've broken your brain.
Well, that's fun.
For the day.
Hey, I'm going to go eat a fried chicken sandwich or something.
Okay.
Oh, wait, maybe not. I don't know. I'll have some kale.
I don't know. He didn't say anything about unethical chicken raising.
Look, one of the things where I was looking up how many chickens you can pack into a truck was site after site after site explaining the ethical treatment of chickens.
Oh, man.
In industrialized farming.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So
that's.
Yeah. Yeah. This has been a real uplifting episode, Brad.
Yeah. Thanks, man. There are no sacred cows or chickens anymore, apparently. So, thanks to everybody who wrote in.
Yeah, the email address is techpod@content.town.
Yes.
And we would love more emails. We'll do another episode of emails in, let's say, 4 weeks.
That sounds like a good number to me.
Yeah. And if you don't like this new regime, send us a note about that, too, because we would love to hear your feedback.
Take any and all feedback.
Yeah. If you think this is a great idea, that's good feedback, too, because otherwise the people who complain will totally drown you out.
That's right. Also, episode ideas, like not necessarily questions for this format, but like topics. We've gotten a handful of pretty interesting topics that I never would have thought of.
Yeah, there were a couple of really good ones in there
that I want to look into a little more.
Things you're curious about. And it doesn't have to be in the computer realm.
Yeah.
It can be in, you know, whatever you want.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that's the thing we probably just have the most hands-on experience with.
Yeah.
But interested in all kinds of stuff around here.
Technology of chicken farming. We're there. Right. Put us in, coach.
Yep.
If you are enjoying the podcast and you don't want to leave personal feedback with an email address, you can always leave us a review on iTunes.
Yeah.
It's the best way to let people know about podcasts you love.
That's where you can quantify the job that you think we're doing.
You could also tell people about the podcast. That's another really nice thing to do.
It's a little bit more of a social outlet, but yeah.
Yeah, if you think this is useful, go to your favorite message boards and be like, hey, I heard of a great new podcast that I'm really enjoying. It's called Brad and Will Made a Tech Pod.
Shout it from the rooftops.
You can find it at techpod.content.town. As always, I'm Will Smith.
I'm Brad Shoemaker.
We'll see you guys next week. Bye, everybody.